Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
Hey, welcome to the Next Wave podcast. Consider us your chief AI officer in your business. My name is Matt Wolf. I have the number one YouTube channel in the AI space. I also run FutureTools.com, and I'm joined by my co-host, Nathan Lands, founder of Lore.com. We want to bring you the latest AI news and trends, show you how you can use AI in your business and personal life, and help make it super easy for you to understand and execute. We're going to equip you with the knowledge to thrive in this upcoming wave of change.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I can't see anybody in Brussels wanting to enter into a conversation with the UK unless they really feel that we're totally in it. We really, really do want to be back in, and there's cross-party consensus and there's high numbers of support amongst the public, and this isn't going to be, you know, the hokey-cokey that we're back in, that we're going back out, etc., etc. And that's a really high, I think that's a really high hurdle to kind of get over.
Hello and welcome to this edition of Behind the Lines. I'm Arthur Snell. Some of you will recall 2 weeks ago my interview with Sidney Nash on Britain's relationship with Europe. It was an extensive discussion and I decided to cut it into two episodes. So here is the eagerly awaited second episode where Sidney gets into what would have to change for the UK to rejoin the EU.
My name is Sidney Nash. I'm a former UK civil servant, so I spent about 10 years working in the UK civil service. I did a range of things before really focusing on EU policy and EU strategy. So I led the work on the UK single market policy under the coalition government before then moving towards strategic engagement with the EU, all the institutions, and indeed the member states as well. I then led the UK automotive sector's work on Brexit and international trade from late 2016 up until 2020. My leaving the UK government in 2016 was nothing to do with Brexit. It happened before the referendum, but the referendum then did fundamentally change the job I was going to do for automotive, which was meant to be new technologies, connecting autonomous vehicles, but it became Brexit and international trade because it was an all-consuming issue for that sector.
In the first part of these two episodes, Sidney and I spoke about the EU, its current situation, and its relations with the UK. This second episode starts with my question to Sidney about where would a Labour government begin to reform the UK's relationship with Europe? Where should we start with that? What are the things, if you're a new Labour government, they need to demonstrate that they're offering benefits to Britain's trading terms of trade. Where would we start? What might be the things that could happen quite quickly that don't look like us joining the customs union, for example?
So what does that then mean for a new government, assuming that's a Labour government?
Yeah.
From the dusty grounds where everything else has been knocked down, you can start building back up again.
Yeah.
And indeed, some of that's kind of happened already. So we've seen that on Horizon, for example, where, you know, we're back in as the UK. I think there are probably other areas where kind of similar things to be done. Perhaps Erasmus could be another one where, you know, the UK can find a way to, as a third country, still participate. Maybe there's something that could be done around the arts and music, for example, you know, little small stats. So there could be things that would be beneficial to particular sectors, things that might be beneficial to particular parts of society, but I don't think there is a big bang solution that Labour could deliver without kind of going back to that really fundamental question of in and out. So, you know, there's still some who talk about what are key things for the UK to rejoin the customs union. Which, strictly speaking, is not something the UK can do. You can be in the customs union if you're in the EU. But we could negotiate a customs union with the EU. It wouldn't be easy. It'd be quite tough. It has knock-on consequences for the EU as well. I won't necessarily kind of bore you about what that means vis-a-vis their relationship with Turkey.
Bore me a little. Give us a bit of the sort of... Because what you're saying is we could negotiate a customs union. It's not... The EU customs union, we would have to negotiate one that is particular to our situation.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. I mean, I think so. I guess the thing is, we need to be realistic about how stark the situation we currently are in vis-a-vis trade to the EU is. Very bare. It's really, really bare bones. So if you want to go from that bare bones situation to something that is putting the building blocks together for frictionless trade, yes, a starting point is going to be around a customs union, shared tariffs, you know, so you eliminate tariff trade. You know, that's going to be stage one. Now, it can sound quite simple, like rejoin the customs union, but like I say, you can't do that unless you're an EU member. So it means negotiate a customs union, the EU. We may feel like that's super beneficial to us. The EU might question how beneficial it is to them, but they only have, I think it's four customs unions with third countries, three of which were tiny countries that were surrounded by the EU, so like Andorra, San Marino, Liechtenstein.
Right.
And then the other ones were Turkey. And it's relatively old. I can't remember the exact date. It's from the 1990s. It's really asymmetric. Turkey doesn't like it at all. They've been constantly pushing to renegotiate it. And the EU consistently says, no, we're not interested. What that actually means from a trade point of view is that when the EU is going negotiating a trade deal, it's essentially doing it on behalf of Turkey as well. And Turkey doesn't really have much of a say in that.
Yeah.
I don't think we'd want that. But the starting point from the EU is like precedence. It's like, well, if you want a customs union, we've got this one off the shelf. So we can basically do something like that, take the word Turkey out, put the word United Kingdom in, and then, you know, do all the kind of the other bits around the edges that need to be rationalized. That's not going to work for the UK. So once the EU starts saying, okay, we'll give you something slightly better, Anchor will be putting his hand up and saying, but what about that renegotiation we wanted? So it kind of creates this three-party dynamic for Brussels, not for us, but for Brussels, which they have to kind of take into account. And to go back to our discussion about kind of security and geopolitics, is a discussion they have to take into account in the context of Russia's war of Ukraine, Turkey's position vis-a-vis that, Turkey's position vis-a-vis the Middle East, et cetera, et cetera. So it's far more complicated than I think some people kind of present. But let's say we did do that, you still don't get frictionless trade, right? Because it's the alignment of your regulations. It's the behind the border barriers that give you frictionless trade.
Yeah.
And this is something that, you know, when I was working in my auto days, we're very, very clear about that. You know, automotive needed, wanted frictionless trade. It's an industry that wasn't very fine margins. And it relies on just-in-time manufacturing. So you've got to get all your components across the border without any delay every single time. But you can only do that if there's no tariffs and complete regulatory alignment, because only that removes the need for any checks.
Yeah.
And there's only one example anywhere in the world of goods moving across borders without any checks between kind of two functioning economies, and that's in the EU. It didn't happen anywhere else. And that's because of the single market and the customs union. So getting it anywhere near that when you're a third country is incredibly difficult. And the only way to actually get to that point is pretty much to be back in the EU, or to be so integrated, like integrated even greater than Norway is, for example, which isn't in a customs union with the EU, to be a complete law taker and not being around the table. And I can't imagine that, again, works for the UK, any political party. So it just feels to me there's a big, big gap between where we are now and where some would like us to be, short of being back in the EU.
Yeah. And so the obviously the rule taker framing is one that I agree with you. The sort of culturally, you know, there may be people listening to this who despair at this point, but I think it's fair to say that current British political and sort of media culture doesn't have the kind of maturity to take that concept on board. We could then argue intellectually about whether it's on balance better or not, but you know, I think that's fair. I suppose there's, you know, people, there are ways, obviously, if you say you are a rule taker, immediately you've sort of
It's
you've
pretty
put
negative,
someone,
right?
yeah. If you talk about dynamic alignment, if you talk about things like that, because you know, one of the things that I think anyone who's been through Brexit has learned is that we were not imprisoned inside the EU. You
No.
know, all we had to do was trigger Article 50, pass an Act of Parliament, and then we left the EU. And it turned out that, you know, that there wasn't some sort of sinister Brussels empire that we were stuck inside. So that realization, you know, is when people say dynamic alignment, does that sort of offer very much, or is it a bit of a catchphrase?
I mean, I think it could do. And if it could be done in, you know, specific sectors, or yeah, I mean, if it's done across a range of sectors, I think the slight challenge with it is it's kind of like, where do you draw the line from a regulatory perspective? Because the economy is highly integrated. So, you know, kind of go back to what I was saying about auto and manufacturing, you know, the good is wrapped around with a service package. So, you know, it turns out it's not just about manufactured goods, it's also about financial services, and it's also about kind of insurance or, you know, whatever else it might be. So it becomes quite tricky to delineate, I think, between some of these things.
So I suppose what you're saying is that let's say you decided to align in the automotive sector, you know, for starting there, but then you end up, well, I have to align maybe on, I don't know, sort of petrochemicals, and I have to
Yeah,
align, you know,
absolutely. Yeah,
and you
chemical,
end up,
environmental standards, you know, yeah, et cetera, et cetera. And yeah, again, this isn't some kind of trap that Brussels creates. It's just the nature of the modern integrated global economy. It's just very, as we discover trying to leave, it's very, very hard to unpick it and to, you know, cherry pick, right? And say, we want that, but we don't want this. Like, it's actually very difficult to do it.
Hence also the people will remember that there was the so-called bonfire of the Brussels regulations, where the Great Repeal Bill, where, you know, thousands of, and even Kemi Badenoch, who is, you know, is pretty hardcore Brexiter, stood up in Parliament and basically accused her fellow Brexiters of, I think, sort of having lost touch with reality. Because if you take away these thousands of laws, that, you know, they're not just there for fun, are they?
No, exactly. Exactly. But you know, I think there are steps that could be, you know, taken by a new government. But I think they'll probably have to be in quite distinct areas, and it might be more around programs. So, like Horizon, that's easy to do. It's like, we want to be back in that program, or we want to kind of facilitate, you know, interactions between our students and students in the EU and continental Europe. That's perhaps slightly easier to do, but I think beyond that, it becomes a little bit more complicated, from a kind of a technocratic point of view. I think there's also kind of a political point around it as well, which is you've got to get permission to do this stuff, you know, especially in the context of everything we've just gone through. So even if it is seemingly small stuff around the edges, or you know, if it is possible to kind of do dynamic alignment in particular small parts of the economy, which you know it may well not be the case. The risk is, if you don't kind of go out and say, this is actually what we're going to do, we want to have a mandate to kind of move close to the EU, to deepen our trade and cooperation agreement, to have dynamic alignment, we're going to hit the same problems again further down the line, that's, you know, it's deemed to be illegitimate. Now, it's perfectly possible for a new government to come in and just do that. It doesn't have to be in their manifesto. You know, the Lords might kick up a stink, but ultimately, you know, the government will get its way. But you just have to get public buy-in to it. And I think what's really absent from the debate, you know, we're not in the election campaign yet, we haven't seen a manifesto. I don't feel like the opposition want to be going into an election seeking permission to do that, for the risk of being accused of being Ramonas or whatever else it might be.
I think you're absolutely right. In a way, they want to say publicly that they're doing nothing except just being sort of smarter, and somehow magically that will transform our relations with Europe. But I suppose then I know that a lot of people who listen to this podcast, perhaps, you know, myself included, would like it if we actually rejoined the EU. And so now no one thinks that can happen overnight. I saw there's polling now that I think 87% of people under 25 would like the UK to rejoin. So we've talked in a way about the kind of things that you could do subtly and sort of try not to show that you were rejoining. Mm. But what if, clearly not in a immediate government that might be elected this year, but what if a future British government, we don't have to imagine which that government might be, because it's at the moment it's not predictable. But what if a future government decided, right, actually, you know, what Sydney's saying is correct, you know, that you can't properly do this if you're not actually in it. So we need to be in it. So what would that be like? Because then we come back to where we began this discussion, which is the EU is not the EU that we joined in the 70s. Mm, yeah. It is grappling with a very different set of sort of global challenges. How do you think that sort of challenge would be addressed, and what might the EU see as its response?
Yeah, so I think the first thing that has to be done, there needs to be a clear public desire for it. So notwithstanding your point about what the polls tell us feels we rejoin versus stay out, I think the polling, when one looks at issues that matter going into a general election, the question of Europe is kind of back at its natural position, which is really, really low down people in terms of people's priorities.
Sure.
2016 was weird because it gave us an up and down vote on an issue that most people had said, I don't care that much about.
Yeah.
And then we're forced to really, really care about it. And we fought about it for many years, a number of years after that. So you got to, first of all, if you're one's in the kind of pro-EU, it'll be better off when we're back in kind of camp, you've got to build that public desire to do it.
Yeah.
Which I think means you have to tell a story about why it's good for the UK. And I think the risk is starting the story about why the EU is good, or why it might be beneficial to be in. But actually, I think it's really a story about us. And we need to kind of understand what the Brexit vote told us about the UK and our union and what we want and the divisions within our country, the challenges that we face, be those geopolitical, regional or domestic, and why being in a multi-country club in Europe benefits the country and benefits individuals in the country, complementary of other things we might well need to do to solve our many problems, most of which are and have always been for us to solve and nothing to do with Brussels anyway.
Yeah.
If that case is made, if there is popular support for that, I think it makes for a much easier conversation with the EU about a desire to go back in. I can't imagine, it's really scarring, the Brexit process, I think, for everybody involved. I certainly felt it, and I wasn't around the negotiation table. I was kind of tangential to it all. I can't see anybody in Brussels wanting to enter into a conversation with the UK unless they really feel that we're totally in it. We really, really do want to be back in, and there's cross-party consensus, and there's high numbers of support amongst the public, and this isn't going to be, the hokey-cokey that we're back in, that we're going back out, et cetera, et cetera. And that's a really high, hurdle to kind of get over. I think once, let's assume that's done.
Imagine we got that,
imagine we've got that. And then we get into kind of like a tricky process question. So, there is the accepted standard approach for how a third country becomes an EU member. And the instinct in Brussels, unless something dramatic changes, you've got to follow that. We're a rules-based system, and we set out these rules, and it's stage one, stage two, stage three, there's many, many years and reviews and blah, blah, blah. So it's not a quick process.
Yeah.
And I think we'd either have to accept that, which again goes back to that it's a multi-parliament, cross-party project, because it won't happen in 5 years. Or we try and make the case of the UK special. But we've kind of done that before. We've done that while we're trying to get out.
Yeah.
I might be a bit tired of it. It doesn't work. We manage it when we're in the clubbers because we're a member. They'll do all kinds of things when you're a member.
Yeah.
But once you're out, it's a totally different discussion. And then I think the other point is the one you were making, but it's a moving target. So the EU that we left in 2016 is not the EU that we see.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Today and it's and the EU we see today is not the one we're going to see in 5-10 years time.
Yeah.
But it's not just that the EU is a moving target, we're a moving target as well. So from the regulatory point of view, each day, each decision, each parliamentary vote, each new bit of legislation, we are drifting apart, or maybe even drifting together, but in ways that are unpredictable, because the decision-making process here and in Brussels is not what does this mean vis-a-vis our relationship with the EU or vis-a-vis our relationship with the UK? It's like we just need to deal with our own politics and law and legislation and regulation for our own economies and our own peoples. And there may well be knock-on consequences for those who aren't in the EU, or knock-on consequences for countries that border the UK. But it's not been managed. You can't really manage it unless you're in the process of going back in, and then you're trying to put these things back together. So they match. You could be a member of the club. So it just makes it very, very difficult. And I think that the kind of dynamic nature of that, of all of this, is not very well understood amongst politicians, and maybe amongst some of those who want us to kind of go back in and campaign for it. That you're really trying to thread the needle in making this happen. But of course, it does become a lot easier if the politics is there.
I mean, it sounds like from what you're saying, we need our politics to change fundamentally. But I suppose, given the state of our economy, that the fact that we are struggling with issues like growth, and particularly the demographics that young people are very keen for Britain to rejoin the EU, perhaps over a decade, that we might see that change.
We may well do, though I think the window of opportunity, your point about young people is a good one and correct, but I think the window of opportunity is quite small, because coming behind a generation of voters who are, say, age 25 now, so the kind of Brexit was the kind of fundamental issue that's framed the beginning of their political life, is a bunch of kids, including my own, who grew up having never been in the EU,
right.
And having not seen any of that. So I don't know if the demographic shift naturally translates into more people wanting to kind of be in the EU, because you then get a bunch of people who don't really know what it was ever like to be in the EU. I guess on the flip side, without being kind of morbid about it is you do get fewer and fewer people who are scarred by the process of leaving the EU.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, any attempt to kind of have this conversation now, I think, is really difficult because I'm not convinced that many people want to have to go through all of that again. Even somebody like myself who's, you know, voted Remain and views our departure as a kind of a strategic error and would rather we'd never done it. I don't know if I have the energy to go through all of that again to try and get us back in right now.
Yeah.
And I'm probably part of a bunch of people who would be more willing to kind of go through the pain because I can see the benefit. I think for the general population, that's a big ask, you know. Do I have to have those fights with my dad again or my mates? And do you have to talk about this again? I mean, there are many reasons why Boris Johnson won a big majority in 2019, but the promise Jeffrey had to not have to talk about this stuff anymore was pretty attractive to a lot of voters.
Yeah. So I suppose, I mean, it sounds to me like you think this is probably not going to happen.
Yeah. I think somewhat pessimistic about it. And I guess my hesitation there is because I'd rather not be. I'd rather be more optimistic. I'd rather be in the position of those who are saying, no, actually, we can get back in and we can reverse this stuff. We can kind of make things better again. But I'm unconvinced that we're going to manage that anytime soon. I think the hurdles are significant, and I don't think they have been fully understood. And it's only once they are that we can kind of get on a kind of a pathway towards rejoining. If that is indeed what the general population think is the best thing for the UK to help deal with the issues here in the UK, I've never been convinced that there's a groundswell of people in the country who have enough love for the idea of the EU to just be like, yes, we should just get in. I don't buy the regret narrative. I think there's a certain degree to which some, I hope I'm not being unfair here, they're still waiting for everybody to regret it so much that they'll all just swing behind a rejoin. I don't think that's ever going to happen. There's just a lot of work that would need to be done to kind of get us back into the club if that's the right thing to do. In the meantime, you know, going back to what we were talking about earlier, the world will keep on evolving. Events will keep on forcing us and others into new decisions. And we may find that the structures change in such a way that we get deep partnerships in areas like security because it's deemed to be mutually beneficial, that allows for a degree of political influence and kind of more kind of foreign policy like influence within a European structure that will be, I think, welcome. That we do find some ways to ease some of the friction in certain parts of the economy, but are unable to do so in others, and those parts of the economy will evolve in different ways as a result. And the more they do that, kind of the less willing they'll then be actually to frankly go back in, because for better or worse, what business quite likes is stability. You know, they often hate the regulation when it's introduced, but once they kind of got their head around it and know how to deal with it, they don't really want it changed again, and we might just find ourselves in that kind of patchwork situation.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I was wondering, whether we'll end up over time, a very British thing, of course, having a whole set of arrangements, which, of course, will increase over time because people will pragmatically say, well, let's do more aligning here. Let's open up this area of the economy. Let's allow free movement when it pertains to a certain type of activity or whatever. And we'll reach a point where we don't have the benefits, but we have quite a lot of the benefits of membership of the EU. And then I suppose the question is whether politically, if you ask the question to the British people, look, we've done a lot of this stuff over the years, basically to sort of try and hack away at the brambles that are getting in everyone's way. And as a result of that, we've ended up surrendering quite a lot of autonomy because we're not a member. So we've done this in a fairly sort of single directional manner, albeit some of it involves dynamic alignment and, you know, a two-way street. So we might as well join. And would British people, so you're not sort of saying this is an amazing sort of moment of our transfiguration as a nation, which is perhaps what it feels like for a country that's come out of, you know, communist dictatorship. But we're saying, well, we might as well join because we've sort of done most of the joining already. Do you think that's a possibility?
Yeah, potentially. You know, the kind of we got this far, so let's rationalize this and make it a bit more straightforward. So that could happen. And you know, certainly, you know, the EU of today, who hate kind of the Swiss approach, which is kind of what you're just describing, lots of different agreements, and it's a patchwork and it's legally quite hard to kind of follow, and it's always slightly kind of fragile. You know, they'd much rather have a neat and tidy, rationalized approach to things. So that could well happen. Whether or not that's consistent with the UK's political culture is another matter, because I think, as you say, we might well end up in that slightly messy position because it kind of fits more naturally of how we tend to do things in the UK, and at least how we've done things in the past. As I say, the future will be the same as the past, of course.
Yeah. Yeah. But I suppose then my final question for you, because I you know, you've come with a very, I think, a very sort of rational, and obviously it's completely experiential, you know, you've lived this world. You've come with that analysis. For those who are very keen, perhaps because of as much these sort of economic and organizational issues, but actually culturally, they feel that they are culturally European, and they feel that should be Britain's future. What could be things that would change the calculus, in your opinion? You know, how could this change so that actually joining the EU as a sort of positive step could be something that Britain is more likely to do?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I guess in many ways, despite my kind of pessimism, you know, those who are kind of fighting a kind of a rejoin approach have my utmost respect, because actually the only thing you can really do is treat politics not as a kind of spectator sport, but to kind of get on the pitch, right? And try and kind of shape the narrative, shape the discussion, frame the questions, and get them answered in the way that you want. And yeah, I think that's what these guys are doing. I guess what I would say is probably two things, right? So one of which is targeted. I think there's an element that's targeted engagement. Yeah. So there are, I mean, I'm a little bit more distant to this than I was a few years ago, but there are certain sectors, I'd say, that were pretty supportive of Brexit, not universally, right, but quite supportive. So like fisheries, I think, were sold a very positive narrative on what Brexit would do for them, and have got pretty badly burnt. And there are some kind of leading individuals in that sector who are kind of reflective of that journey. I live down in the southwest. There are communities down here who have really felt that quite starkly.
Yeah,
I think there's targeted engagement with parts of the country, communities, parts of the economy, who've been hit very, very hard about this and may well actually be in that kind of regret kind of space.
Yeah.
So, you know, start with that. But actually, you've got to change minds. It's not enough to keep on talking to, you know, people like you and me who voted Remain. I'm not saying forget about us, but we're not going to swing this. You're kind of going to go and talk to those who voted Leave, and get them into a position that is more supportive, and actually get them to help shape your own thinking about this, because it's a conversation for us in the UK, right, initially. So I think there's that kind of targeted approach. But I think there is an overlay of kind of a macro point as well, which is, I think the economic arguments are very powerful at the macro level. They didn't really work, right, at the referendum.
Yeah.
Because it turned out it was maybe more of an identity question, and that it was, I guess, a kind of a global versus national, perhaps, for want of a better term, question. So how does one engage with that? And I think probably the way to do it is almost not having a discussion specifically about the EU. It's actually a much more difficult conversation about our country and the communities within it in a globalized economy, and how we make sure we are able to protect, promotes and ensures the prosperity of all the parts of the country, you know, each part of the country in that context. Now, I don't have the intellectual case for that right here and now, but I think that's the one that kind of needs to be made. I think what Brexit showed us in some way, it just kind of exposed what was already there, but that kind of stark clash between an old world and a new world, which have been living together, but actually quite uncomfortably.
Yeah.
And we hadn't really recognized how uncomfortable it was. And 2016 exposed it. It exposed the deep dissatisfaction many parts of the country had with the world that we're living in right now. We can't reshape the world. We can't, I don't think, undo globalization. You can't uninvent the internet or aeroplanes or any of this kind of stuff. That this exists. But we can have a conversation about how do we use our own politics, our own economy, our own sovereignty to deliver the best outcomes for the people of the UK in that context. And if part of delivering that means we need to be at the table of the second most important economy in the world, which has enormous regulatory influence that spreads way beyond its boundaries and is dealing with an enormous security issue. And we need to be part of that discussion because Russia is not far away from the UK, and we have a role to play. And historically, we've never been able to disengage from conflicts on continental Europe. We must know that by now, right? That is part of how we make sure the outcomes for you in England, Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland, in Devon, Birmingham, Edinburgh, Cardiff, whatever, are going to be the best for you, your community, your family, your children, et cetera, et cetera. So I think it's finding that way to draw these things together and making sure the conversations about the best for the UK, and this is part of how you deliver it. It's not the answer to everything. The last thing you need to do is say that it is the magic wand that makes everything better.
No.
Well, that's just the mirror of the Brexiteers saying that leaving is the magic wand that's going to make everything better. It will not. So we've got to make it a conversation about this is part of a package of getting the UK into a place where we are more prosperous, we are more united, you are happier, and there's a more desirable future for your children going forward. I think that's the kind of thing that needs to be done.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose the one thing is that if you are in this campaign, which is obviously at this stage is still hypothetical, the join movement is the one making a positive case, whereas arguably, oddly, you know, what the Brexit movement was able to do was to say this is the positive choice, that your life is not satisfactory and you can make a positive choice to, as it were, take back control, blah, blah, blah. Whereas at least now, if there were to be this future debate, those of us advocating rejoin would be asking people to take a positive step. And maybe that completely changes the framing of the campaign.
I think that's absolutely right, actually. If there's two types of campaign, right, it's like time for a change or let's finish what we started.
So if
the world is still kind of looking bleak and all the rest of it, the change narrative is the powerful one. And like you say, the side that has the change narrative has now changed.
Well, I think that feels like a good place to stop, because we're talking about how a positive campaign could lead to Britain rejoining the EU. Admittedly, neither of us knows exactly what circumstances would lead us there, but perhaps it's something to at least hold on to as a sort of possibility for a future. So it just remains for me to thank you, Sydney, for joining us today.
It's been a real pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Behind the Lines, presented and produced by me, Arthur Snell. If you don't want to miss another episode, make sure you've subscribed. We've got some great interviewees coming up, starting next week with Dr. Helena von Bismarck, a German expert on Britain. Join me then. Thanks, goodbye.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.